to go and pile in the teacher, John Shaw, once asked me to give a talk in Thai, which I couldn't speak very well, wanted me to give a sermon to the people, because I'd been there for a number of years at the monastery and had taken full advantage of my excuse that I couldn't speak their language, so I could remain silent and just listen to what was being said without having to say anything back. And then suddenly he was asking me to give a talk, and then you have to sit up on a high seat and towering over everybody, looking down on all these people, speaking and having to speak a language which you don't have any confidence in your ability to use. And Thai is a language which is a tonal language, in which it's monosyllabic, something like Chinese, so that the tone you use with the monosyllables is very important, otherwise the meaning can change. It can be quite embarrassing, some of the things you're saying without meaning to. So I had this kind of dread at this time of having to get up there and say something, trying to kind of inspire faith in the people, you know, saying something very uninspiring to them. From that time on, I've been, seems to have been my fate to be put in such positions of having to give talks to people. And my first, I started this in Thai, which I learned to use after a while. And the teacher said, never prepare a talk. Never plan it out ahead of time. Only teach from what you know and from the present moment, rather than, say, setting out a whole series of titles and then arranging outlines and then giving out information that you've prepared. So most of us who've been with Ajahn Chah trained ourselves to do this, and sometimes we sit down on these high seats and the mind just goes blank. Yesterday, the two previous talks, one, the first one on the Four Noble Truths, the second one on the Ten Paramitas. The third one I thought I'd probably try to talk about what is the big obstacle to a concentrated mind, are the what we call the five hindrances. And just learning to deal with these five hindrances, learning to understand them and to accept their presence in one's own mind is a way of, say, being very wise. As long as we try to suppress or ignore the hindrances, we will always be running from life and never fully with anything. We'll never have a calm heart or a peaceful mind. So these five hindrances, some people think all you have to do is teach just the way to deal with these five hindrances. And they're just ordinary things, there's nothing spectacular about them. Lust or greed for something, hatred or aversion towards something, mental dullness, or what they call sloth and torporousness, then there's doubt and irresolution and restlessness. So, if you've noticed in your own mind, these are the things that make you struggle. And when you when these are present in your mind, your mind is not at peace. You tend to react. So, in meditation, the understanding of these five hindrances and learning to the investigation of these five hindrances, when one of them is present, you investigate it, you understand it, you accept its presence, and you learn how to deal with it. Sometimes you can just tell it to go away and it goes. Sometimes you have to just allow it to be there till it wears out. Sometimes we have subtle ways of being averse to that which is unpleasant, and we tend to not be very honest with our intentions because we don't really understand our intentions. Our habits are, as soon as something unpleasant arises, to try to move away from it or destroy it. So as long as we're doing this, we don't have any what we call samadhi or concentration. It's only after when these five hindrances are absent, or we're no longer attached to them, or no longer grasping hold of them, that we find any peace of mind or a concentrated heart. To understand how to deal with lust or greed, we can talk about it, analyze it with words. We can understand it because we all experience greed and lust. But it's only in the moment when it actually arises that we can really penetrate it and have insight into it. Even though if you've noticed, you go to some of these lectures and talks and you get such a kind of inspired and profound understanding of the Dhamma, but you still get angry, lose your temper, or frightened, feel lust and desire for things, and even though you've just come from a very inspiring talk and you feel you have a really profound understanding of the subject, when the actual situation arises, you're not mindful of it. You tend to resist or resent or just indulge. I remember in my first year as a samanera, this was before I went to Ajahn Chah, I spent the first year very much alone in a monastery in the northeast, where they let me just be there. I wasn't compelled to do anything other than just live in this little cottage, and they brought me food every day, the monks. And I didn't speak Thai, so I didn't have to talk to anybody. Nobody could speak English. So I just sat there for about 4 or 5 months, meditating, walking up and down, doing all these practices. And I didn't read any books, didn't watch any television. I didn't talk to anybody. So it was what we call sensory deprivation. The senses aren't being stimulated very much, and you find your mind becoming very tranquil. So tranquil that I attain great states of bliss and ecstasy. I sit on the porch of my little cottage, and tears would come to my eyes with love for the mosquitoes who were biting me. I could think in abstract terms about all beings, this great love for all beings everywhere. And this kind of emotion would rise up, and what they call pity, tears flowing out, a sense of bliss. You feel, I love all beings, and even your enemies or those who had caused you suffering in the past, you forgave them all. You have this very high-minded, ecstatic feeling in regards to all beings, mainly because you weren't having to live with them. So then one day I was thoroughly enjoying all I had to, orders came from the immigration. This was in Nong Khai, which is the town where if you're going to Vientiane in Laos, you have to go to Nong Khai and cross the Mekong River. I had to go into the immigration because my visa was out of date. So here, spending this past few months in a very high state of great love for all beings, I had to leave the monastery, and I had a heightened sense of awareness. I was walking through the town, and I looked, and you could see kind of in a clearer way things that you'd never noticed. You look at the faces of people, you see the kind of sorrow and anguish on people's faces that before you would never have noticed. I kept walking in this kind of state of extreme sensitivity and heightened awareness. Walked through the town to the immigration. And there, as soon as I walked into the immigration, I felt like an iron wall, an iron curtain of hatred coming at me. It was like, I was so sensitive at this time, I just walked in the door and suddenly I felt this wall of negativity and aversion. And even though there was no overt signs of it, like no one was shaking their fists or cursing, I knew that there was some great negative feeling towards me. And I found out that the leading monk of the province had ordered them to give me a visa which wasn't quite in line with their regulations, and that they were being forced to put into a position which was really quite unfair, I thought afterwards. But because of that, they had a definite aversion toward me. And then they made it rather difficult and wouldn't give me the visa anyway. And it became very confusing for me because of this heightened sense of awareness and this feeling of great love for all beings began to fade out very quickly. By the time I returned to the monastery, I was in a frantic mental state, and I went back to my cottage, and I determined that I had to spend the next 3 days just calming down all that had been aroused during that hour visit to the immigration. Then a few months later, I became so fond of this kind of isolated life, the hermetic living, that it was so peaceful not to be exposed to the misery of other people, or to have your senses excited or stimulated by the ways of others. Nature itself, if you're living in a natural setting, is very peaceful and very pleasant to be with. and even mosquitoes, which you might think would be terribly annoying, aren't if you're they aren't anywhere near as annoying as people are. Actually much easier to live with. It takes much less skill to live with mosquitoes than with another person. We had to cling to this kind of hermetic life, and then a few months later I had to go to Bangkok. And there, any of you who have been to Bangkok, you can understand, maybe have some sympathy for someone who's been living a very peaceful, tranquil life as a hermit, suddenly being confronted by this very confusing, noisy, unpleasant city. And there, I just half an hour in Bangkok, my mind was in a terrible condition. You know, I remember sitting on the train from Nong Khai to Bangkok. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was sitting there just with these high-minded thoughts, thinking about helping all beings, dedicating my life to the welfare of all beings. And I think of the Dhamma and the Buddha, and this overwhelming kind of bliss would permeate me. And I felt such a wonderful state of mind to be in. But then the practical realities of living in Bangkok and having to arrange visas and dealing with the civil service and living at monasteries with the monks were didn't ever seem to have such high-minded thoughts as I did. Was very confusing and disillusioning for me. But from that experience, I began to see that that was not necessarily the way to enlightenment, was to shut yourself off from everything that was unpleasant. In other words, in regards to that which is unpleasant, which we experience, we have to learn to wisely understand it. As I've been stressing in previous talks, that which is really difficult and unpleasant in our lives is no doubt there for a purpose. We have to learn a lesson, and that particular condition is there to teach us. So no matter how much we don't want it and would rather life be otherwise, somehow those conditions persist in our lives until we've understood them through wisdom and have transcended them. So the conditions for my hermetic life ended soon after that, and I found that I was going to be ordained as a bhikkhu, higher ordination, and I had the opportunity to go and live with Ajahn Chah at a monastery where I would not be allowed the luxury of hermetic practice. I'd have to live in a community of monks and perform my duties, learn all these disciplinary rules that bhikkhus have to learn, and live under the authority of someone else. And I was, by this time I was quite willing to do this. I realized that it would be very good for me. It was exactly what I needed. I didn't need any more blissful, ecstatic mental states that disappeared immediately when something annoying happened to you. I thought I needed to put myself in a position in which a constant stream of annoying conditions would come at me, and I would learn to just be equanimous. And I found Wat Pa Phong very much offering those constant annoying condition that I realized would be good for me. And there, I had a very good chance to deal with the five hindrances in a very constant way. The Ajahn Chah immediately when I arrived, where before at every other monastery in Thailand I'd lived in, just the fact of being a Westerner gave you, you could expect to have the best of everything. They'd always arrange to give you the best food or the best place to live. You never were expected to have to do all the work or the things that the other monks did. You could get away with, I'm busy meditating right now. I don't have time to sweep the floor. Let the others do it. I'm a serious meditator. Ajahn Chah said when people would say, "I don't think he's an American, you know. I don't think he can eat the food here. Americans can't eat the kind of food we eat." And so Ajahn Chah said, "He'll have to learn." Some kind-hearted Chinese in the town offered to bring specially prepared Chinese food for me, and he forbade it. And I was given a meditation hut that I didn't like, and I asked if I could have one that I liked, and he said no. I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and attend these chanting, morning chanting and meditations, and they'd have these readings from the Vinaya. They'd read them in Thai, which I couldn't understand, and even when I could understand them, they were excruciatingly boring to have to listen to. And he'd read it about how one monk ripped a hole in his robe, and then there was this rule made that all monks who have holes in the robes have to sew up the hole. If it's so many inches from the hem, it has to be sewed up before dawn. And I kept thinking, this isn't what I ordained for, to get caught up in all these meticulous rules, trying to figure out whether the hole in my robe is 4 inches from the hem or not, and whether I should sew it up before dawn. Or they'd read about how to make a sitting cloth, and some monks would say, no, it has to have the edge, the border has to be so many inches wide. And then there'd be another monk say, well, I've seen sitting cloth made with a border different from that. And then you find people, the monks becoming even argumentative about the border on your sitting cloth. In my mind was one which I, let's talk about serious things, things of importance like the Dhamma. But when it came to the pettiness of daily living and living with people of different temperaments, and problems and characters whose minds were not necessarily as inspired as mine seemed to be at that time, I felt a great kind of depression. I was suddenly faced with the hindrances as a practical reality, with no escape until I had learned how to learn to understand the lesson that these hindrances were there to teach. The life at Wat Pa Phong was the teacher never allow you to get very high. In other words, the life itself was one where you had to do a lot of work. physical work and conform to a community and kind of give yourself up to it, let go of your own personal desires for peace and tranquility and for your own, what you thought was necessary for your own practice. One was, in other words, put in a position where one had to learn to give out, where rather than just take from the society that you were living in. As a monk, the first hindrance of greed. Now you'd be surprised at some of the forms that would take, because being a monk, you don't have the wide range of things to be greedy about. You as a layman, where you can say have greed for good food, lust, sexual desires, that you can spend time trying to seek out suitable objects. You can for material possessions. For the monk, the lust and greed was focused on things that before maybe or most of you would think were not would not particularly arouse lust or greed in your mind. Because when we live a celibate life and we have very few possessions, we found our greed accumulating on say like the robe or the begging bowl. The food, we were allowed one meal a day, so that a lot of greed and aversion would arise in regards to food. A place to live, we were allowed, we had to accept whatever hut we were given. We were not allowed to choose. I don't like this hut, this is my kind of hut. Whatever hut they gave you, they had to stay there. So that sometimes you were fortunate, you got a really nice one. Sometimes you had not a very nice one. But then you could watch the aversion that arose if you were given something you didn't like, or you were given something you liked. I became obsessed with robes for the first few months. The color of the robe, believe it or not. The monastery that I lived at before, they wore kind of bright orange. It would knock your eyes out, kind of orange. And it was not my color. So when I went to Wat Pha Phung, they wore this kind of ochre yellow or brownish color. And so I had this great desire. At first they wouldn't give me one of these robes. I had to wear the knock your eye out orange colors. And I became very greedy to get robes, big robes, because the robes in Thailand never fit me properly. And here they'd make them to the size. You have them tailor-made, custom-made robes. And so then I want a big robe in that kind of dark, in that kind of yellowish brown color. So finally, after a month or so, Ajahn Chah suggested that a monk make me these robes. And then I became obsessed by the color. I didn't want it too brown. And I didn't want very much red in it. I went through a lot of sorrow and despair in regards to getting the right color for the robe. Then the alms bowl. When I went to Wat Pha Phung, I had a rusty alms bowl. In most monasteries in Thailand, the alms bowl is almost totally neglected. They, the monks don't really respect their alms bowls and don't use them. But at Wat Pho Phung, we had to use our alms bowl to eat in, and it was a focal point for mindfulness, so that I had one of these small rusty alms bowls which was given me at ordination. And then they gave me a big alms bowl with a hole in the bottom of it. And alms bowls became quite a focal point for greed. You know, he kept admiring someone else's alms bowl. Then in the vineyard, since we couldn't eat anything in the afternoon, we were allowed, there's certain things they allowed in the vineyard. One was sugar and honey. So then I found myself suffering from fantastic obsession with sweets. And where before I hadn't really cared about sweets at all, when I went to Wat Pho Phung, I became obsessed with the idea of sugar. And once in a while they'd have maybe a sweet drink once every two or three days in the afternoon, and one just began to anticipate waiting for the day that they would give you tea with sugar in it. Or coffee with sugar in it. And once, several times, they even made cocoa. And when word got around that we were having cocoa that evening, one couldn't think about anything else. I didn't find sexual desire any problem in those days because my obsessions were with sugar and sweet. At night and I dream about pastry shops. I find myself sitting in pastry shops going in and ordering the goopiest pastries available, all with pink frosting, and I'd be, as they'd be sitting at the table just about ready to put one of these in my mouth, and I'd wake up. And I thought, if only I could just get one bite. Living under under discipline when you've been living. Very much living life on your own terms. I'd lived before that. I had spent quite a few years in Berkeley, California, the time where, and it probably still is very much in the living in the same way of doing your own thing and doing what you want, and there's no sense of having to obey anybody or live under a discipline of any sort. I'd been conditioned to living very much on my own terms, and then finding myself in a situation where I had no authority whatsoever, and I had to live following a tradition that I didn't always like or approve of, and I had to obey those who were in, who were senior to me, I didn't mind obeying Ajahn Chah because I respected him, but sometimes I had to obey monks I didn't like very much, who I thought were definitely inferior to me. The Thai monks were very critical of me when I went there. Where before the other monastery, I would say, they would praise me all the time. The Thais would say, how beautiful you are. First time in my life I'd ever felt that I was a raving beauty. And a beautiful skin you have. And they like white skin. And my skin is not really very beautiful, but it is white. And Lhasa Phokong, the monks would say, you have ugly skin, have brown spots. Then I was in my 30s at the time, so and still sensitive to the aging process, and they were saying, they'd ask, how old are you? And I'd say, 33. And they'd say, really, we thought you were at least 60. Then they would criticize the way I walk and say, you don't walk right. You aren't very mindful when you walk. Well, I'd take this bag. They gave me a bag and I just kind of dump it down. So I didn't think it was very important. And they would say, you don't put your bag down like that. You take it like this, you fold it over, and then you gently set it down beside you like that. Isn't that beautiful? Such aggravation at these corrections that were being made. The way I ate, the way I walked, the way I talked, everything was criticized or made fun of. And I felt, of course I don't think anybody likes to be in such a position, but something in me made me stay on and endure through it. I actually learned how to conform to, say, a tradition and a discipline. And that took a number of years, really, because there was always a strong resistance. Even though I out of, say, convenience and not wanting to make life any more difficult than it was, I would just put up with a lot of things that I didn't particularly like. And then through the years, I began to understand the wisdom of the discipline that the bhikkhus were trained with. There's a lot of wisdom in the rules of the Vinaya that wasn't all that apparent just on reading the Vinaya Pitaka, or as one might see the Vinaya practiced in a monastery on a superficial level. I found that that this mental proliferation, this became so very clear and apparent under these conditions, wanting, feeling annoyed at others and then dwelling on that annoyance, having opinions about the tradition and the discipline itself. You think this rule isn't necessary. Or you feel like some kind of custom that they would perform was stupid or ridiculous. And you could spend hours of your day just rationalizing this in your mind, saying, this is 20th century, these things aren't necessary. And your mind would keep going and you'd keep watching this kind of discontent and mental proliferation going on inside you, and then you keep asking yourself, is this suffering? And you keep watching the emotional reactions you'd have to the conditions you were living under, to being corrected, to being criticized, or to being praised. And through the years, one developed equanimity. It just seemed to happen. One found that anger annoyance, hatred, aversion, these negative conditions began to fade out, or you weren't getting so wound up or so caught up into just dwelling in aversion on things around you. And when your mind no longer inclined towards dwelling in aversion on things, you began to have some joy or some peace of mind. Then one felt a kind of attachment to the whole tradition. As you gain confidence in the practice, in the teacher, and in the monastery, you developed a kind of obsessive attachment to it. And I couldn't see any faults with it. I began to just see that it helped me tremendously. I was very grateful, and that I felt, this is what everybody should be doing. And then you develop what's called kind of the evangelical missionary outlook on life. And people would come to the monastery, Westerners, and you'd kind of feel that it was your duty to convert them. And I can understand how the missionaries must feel, and you feel very inspired by something and very attached to something that's helped you, that's given you a lot of happiness and a lot of insight. Then you feel compelled to tell everybody else about it, whether they want to hear it or not. So it was all right as long as the Westerners who came agreed with me. That was nice, and they and I could inspire them, and they would feel the same sense of dedication. We could reinforce each other. We could get together in the evenings and talk about our tradition, our way of life, our teacher being the best. And we've really discovered something wonderful. We could inspire each other this way and mutually support each other. But then, inevitably, there'd be some kind of negative American or Englishman come to the monastery who would not fall for any of this. And they would see nothing but the faults and the imperfections. This happened very strongly one year, about my fifth year, when an American came who he had been at the Zen Center in San Francisco, said he was a disciple of Suzuki Roshi. And so then he proceeded to find fault with Ajahn Chah, with the Wat Pa Pong, the Theravada Buddhism, with the Vinaya. And everything, he was quite an intelligent person, and he had certainly had a lot of experience in going from one teacher to another, one ashram, one monastery, and finding fault with them. So this put doubts into the minds of people. And maybe there was a better way to do this, where before we'd all convinced ourselves that this was the only way, the niggling doubt came into the mind. Maybe there's a better way to do it, a quicker way, faster way. Maybe Ajahn Chah is an old-fashioned nobody. Maybe we should go, we heard there was a teacher in India that was giving meditation courses that people were becoming sotapannas almost immediately after one of those courses. I don't know if I'm a soda bunny yet or not. If I could just have a teacher come and tell me, verify it, it'd be really nice to know. And then I, to know where you're at in this meditation. Ajahn Chah won't say anything to you. So I felt a strong aversion arise toward this American. I felt a need to tear down every other type of Buddhism, every other teacher, every possible alternative, because it was a way of feeling I have to protect my own. So I became very critical, and every time anybody would say, I know of a better system, a better method, a better teacher, I would immediately, rather than listen to why it was better, I would listen for every possibility of why it was worse and why it would be inferior. So I developed a habit of tearing down other teachers and other traditions. But this brought me no joy. And I looked at them, at my mind, I could see that this wasn't right to do this. That always having to defend something because you're attached to it, and to tear down something else that you feel threatens the kind of security you find in your attachment, began to see as suffering, a hindrance. One of the devatuttas, the hindrances, arose. For one thing, doubt itself. When somebody says, your teacher isn't any good, and I know of a better way to do it, if you've never really understood doubt, the nature of uncertainty in your own mind, then you get overwhelmed with doubt, because you don't really know. As long as you don't understand this hindrance of doubt or not knowing, you could easily be thrown by it. So that somebody says, I know a better way, a quicker way, you start doubting, well, maybe there's a better way or a quicker way. And then they well, would you describe this better and quicker way? And they describe in very rational terms how to do it quickly, and then you think, well, yes, maybe that's the way to do it. Then, but if you're attached and feel loyal to your teacher, then you think, can't do that. Then you think, it's better to do it the slow way and be sure. So then you start putting down anybody who suggests that there's a faster way to do anything, or a better way. But the important thing through this is that the teaching that was obviously I needed to learn and understand was my own doubting mind. It wasn't up to me to decide about which was the best or the fastest way to do anything, but to understand my own doubt and uncertainty when contrasting views were given to me. So I began to really investigate the mental state of uncertainty that would arise when doubts would be put into my mind, and I would concentrate on that. So that after a while I began to accept any kind of doubting condition, and began to understand it as a changing condition. So that one day I had a very clear insight into this, in which I had been in Bangkok, and people were talking a lot about comparing religions, one religion with another. And I had thought, I was trying to be very tolerant at this time, and kind of accepting all religions are equally good. Even though I didn't really think so. I thought that's the way one should kind of be in the society I was in. So people bring up Christianity, I'd always try to say something very good about it, and about how the goal is the same, and we're and that we should love the Christians, and trying to have metta for all Christians. But I really felt that somehow Buddhism was better. So I, one day on the street, right on the street, this was bothering me, because I thought, what if somebody asked you that, which is the best religion? What would you say? And it just give, from your own opinion, from opinion only, what would you say? And I say, well, Buddhism. Yeah, that's what I'd say. I'd say Buddhism. And then suddenly it became very clear that that was only an opinion. And that opinions were impermanent conditions, and they were not self, and that you didn't need to have an opinion. You didn't have to believe opinions. And that it wasn't up to me to evaluate or make judgments about anything, that I didn't have to be the authority, the one who could say this is better than this, that is better than that, and that whether Christianity was equal, better or inferior to Buddhism, it was no business of mine, and I had no need to, I felt no longer any obligation to even think about it or try to figure it out. Became very clear that all I had to do was just be aware of the desire to understand, to know, and to be able to say to others, this is better than that. One time, several years, I became obsessed with jealousy. Being the senior monk, when other Western monks started coming to live with Ajahn Chah, I began to feel terribly jealous if they were praised, or I was in any way, say if somebody said, this monk is better than Sumato, I'd feel a tremendous sense of jealousy arise in my mind. This kind of competitiveness, feeling that one had to always kind of hold one's own out in front of everybody else. I felt, being the senior monk, I had to set a perfect example of perfect behavior. So when somebody say that other monk is a better example to than Sumato, I'd feel terribly jealous and angry at this. But then I found that jealousy was, I didn't like this, I didn't like to be jealous. And it's a most unpleasant mental condition to have in your mind. So I tended to repress it. I would say, I'll practice mudita. And somebody say, that monk is better than Sumato, I say, to myself, isn't that wonderful? He's better than me. But I still feel jealous. So then, I thought, how do you deal with this one, with jealousy? And so I kept bringing up jealousy in my mind, rather than jealousy was something one tended to try to either repress. My tendency was try to reject it, and I thought that maybe mudita, as I understood it, like saying, oh, how glad I am for that person that he's better off than I am. There is only words, but emotionally I felt an aversion to the jealousy, because I thought it's wrong for me to be jealous. But the emotion still would arise. So then one had to look at the emotion. And rather than trying to make the emotion go away, I realized that was my problem. I was always trying to get rid of it. How do you deal with it? If you're trying to get rid of something, maybe you should try to bring it up more. So I started concentrating on jealousy, and every time I'd think of every possible thing that would arouse jealousy. And I'd keep looking at the feeling of this jealousy. I'd keep examining it and just observing its changing nature. And after a while, as I became more intent, as I kept bringing jealousy up all the time and kept looking at it, rather than trying to figure out ways of getting rid of it, it began to fade out. Began to dwindle. The resentment toward it, the aversion, disappeared. And one began to see that this was only a natural condition of the mind, and that it wasn't self. So this is with sleepiness or mental dullness. This is another good teacher, one of the hindrances. When you no longer feel inspired by your life, and there's a lot of aversion and unpleasantness in the monastic life, and first you kind of, when you're ordained, you feel a lot of inspiration, at least I do, and then you have a lot of energy. And then you find yourself becoming very dull. Mentally very dull. You don't like to think of yourself as being a dull person. And so you find yourself sitting listening to talks and you're falling asleep. All you want to do is really go off and sleep. Or you want to sit in a place and just kind of go into a dull, concentrate on just dullness. You just kind of let the mind go into a dull mental state. You don't put any effort into anything. But then you try to resist this dullness. You think, we used to have to sit up all night on the moon days in Thailand, and we'd have to sit all night long till dawn, and it was at first it was like being an American. We're very competitive, and we like to look good in front of others. So that I'd sit there and I'd, just through sheer willpower, hold myself up all night. And I'd see the Thai monks, some of them sinking down, going like this, some almost falling over. And I look with contempt on these. I'm better than that. I won't allow myself to give in to sleepiness or dullness. And so after a while, I found myself, the will to just sheer will propping me up would fade out, and then I'd find myself sinking down and then falling on my face on the floor. And then feeling aversion at this mental state. And then trying to, just out of sheer will, making myself stay awake. And what this happens, when if you've ever tried this, just out of sheer willpower you hold yourself up, you find yourself going into a state where you don't really know what's going on. You just you start hallucinating. So I kept observing it. I had this aversion to sleepiness, mental dullness. And just sheer willpower wasn't the way to deal with it. Then I thought, what do you do with this one, this hindrance? And I reflected on it. And if it's something you don't like, something you want to conquer and get rid of, that means that's the very problem. Trying to get rid of something you don't want is dukkha, is what the Buddha said. We chant it every morning in Pali. We say, wanting to get rid of something you don't like is suffering. I don't like sleepiness. I don't like mental torpor. I want to get rid of it. How do you deal with this? If you don't want to get rid of it, then I'll try, like with jealousy, I'll just accept it. I'll let it be there. I'll investigate mental, just the feelings of sleepiness and dullness. I'll allow it to be. I won't try to change it. And I thought, I had a doubt about this also. I thought, I'll just fall asleep, I know. I'll just disgrace myself in front of all the other monks. But what I found was that there is awareness of this state, that one can concentrate on the feeling of sleepiness itself. Mental torpor, physical fatigue, and I just contemplate the sensations around the eyes and the feelings in the body, and just observe the mental condition and the kind of the habitual resistance I develop toward it. And after a while, that hindrance no longer became a problem to me. So this is, since that's the bell, I've presented this talk mainly for practical advice on how to deal with hindrances in your practice, in your life. Wisdom arises in us when we understand the things that are here and now, which we're experiencing here and now. It's not like you have to do anything special. You don't have to go out and experience all kinds of extreme pain in order to transcend pain. Just the ordinary pain of your daily life is enough to be enlightened with. Just the discomfort of just the feelings of hunger or thirst or restlessness or jealousy or fear, lust and greed, sleepiness, all these, as they arise in our lives, we can regard as teachers. Rather than resenting, saying, what did I do to deserve this? You should say, thank you very much. I'll have to learn this lesson someday. I might as well do it now rather than put it off. So I offer this for your reflection. I guess that's all for today.